Welcome to Power Play, the Halloween edition. Coming up on today's show, well, there is something a little scary going on south of the border. We will look at the wild swings in the U.S. election campaign as Donald Trump regains some momentum based on emails no one has seen, which may or may not implicate Hillary Clinton in something. Our eagle eye on Washington has the latest. And there's been no increase in security incidents, yet pepper spray incidents have soared in Canadian prisons. The correctional investigator joins us with his annual report's observations. And another six independents are joining a Senate where non-affiliated senators are about to form the largest bloc in the red chamber. The press gallery gives the appointments and their partisanship a reality check. But first, to the politically charged issue of immigration. Well, earlier this month, the government's economic gurus urged a 50% boost in immigration levels over 5 years.
But we also put forward a pretty bold program in terms of increasing the amount of immigration. It's flanged in over a five-year period. We're not taking it up in 1 year because we have to make sure we do it properly. But we think it's something that we need to act on now to be able to move that forward.
But the immigration minister surprised observers by ignoring that advice for the time being and keeping next year's numbers frozen at the 2016 level.
For 2017, we will make that 300,000 permanent, and it will become the foundation of future growth in immigration.
Okay, well, within the limit, there will be an increase in economic immigration and a small increase in family reunifications. There is a decline in refugees and humanitarian immigration. Well, when it comes to this issue, nothing escapes the notice of immigration lawyer Chantal Desloges, and she joins us from Toronto. All right, Chantal, do you think they got it right with this, keeping it frozen at this year's level and boosting immigrations from economic immigration?
Yeah, I think politically, this is probably about the best that they could get away with this year. Public opinion simply wasn't behind a large increase in immigration levels for 2017. And with the economy being what it is, you know, a lot of people still have this opinion in the back of their minds that immigrants take away jobs, which of course is not true, but a lot of people do have that opinion. But I do think also that boosting the economic class immigration was probably the right decision. As opposed to last year, we had a huge increase in refugees. I don't think that's sustainable over the long term.
And is it the government isn't ready to handle that many an issue as well? Or was that it? They say we can't get another 150,000 right away?
Yeah, there's just no way. I mean, the way the system is set up now, they're already working at pretty maximum capacity. If they were going to have a huge increase in immigration, it would require, you know, staffing up the immigration department way beyond what they have now and resourcing it properly. In addition, you have to look at things like settlement services. When people get here, they need all kinds of government services in order to establish themselves, and those things aren't in place either. So that, I think, is a bit of a long-term project.
I wonder, though, if they even had gone to 450,000, would that many come in, or is that just sort of an aspirational target down the road?
Well, those targets are for issuance of permanent resident visas. What nobody really keeps track of course, is the attrition of immigrants. I mean, how many people actually use those visas? When they come in and do use those visas, do they actually stay here? So the number of visas that they give out every year doesn't necessarily translate into newcomers that stay here over the long term.
Right. Now, refugee levels will drop from about 56,000 to 40,000. I'm wondering, does this signal refugee fatigue a bit in Canada?
I think that's exactly what it is. And I mean, like I said before, those numbers that we saw last year, that was a one-time spike. It was a special initiative, and it's not sustainable over the long term. You know, already we've seen some problems with, you know, the administration of that program and people coming in en masse and not having proper resources. So I think that was something that, you know, was a special case. And over the long term, I don't think you'll see that repeated again and again.
Right. And I had to laugh. The Conservatives are saying, well, they finally come around to embracing our immigration plan. Have they essentially done that in your view, or is there quite a difference between what's coming out today and what the Conservatives were proposing?
Yeah, aside from a modest increase in numbers, it is pretty much on a level. I don't see too much there that's drastically different. You know, the emphasis on economic immigration over other kinds. There was a modest increase in the quota for parental sponsorships, which, you know, that was an election issue. It was an election promise to increase family reunification. So they're sort of keeping that, but in a modest way. But yeah, on the whole, it's just staying the course. And I have to say, there was so much excitement and buildup up to this point. I mean, everybody's surprised that it didn't go anywhere.
And what about international students? That's something that the minister dangled as something he would be changing in the near future.
Yeah, absolutely nothing on that. I mean, the problem is, of course, international students, in order for them to transition into permanent resident status nowadays, it's quite difficult for them. And there's been no action on that front. It would not surprise me if you saw something about that very soon, because I know the government is very aware of this problem. And everybody from every side is telling them that this is something they need to fix.
All right. Finally, this just moved, so you might not have seen it yet, but the government has announced that it's going to waive the visa requirement for Romanians and Bulgarians. You think that's a good move?
Well, I think whenever you're dealing with visas for European countries, it is a political issue. Over the past few years, we haven't seen a lot of irregular immigration from places like Romania and Bulgaria. So I think that, yes, it's a pretty safe move. It's probably sensible if we're expecting, reciprocal favors from Europe as well.
Okay, it doesn't hurt that we just signed a free trade deal with them. So, okay, thank you very much, Chantel. Appreciate you coming on.
Thank you.
All right, now to the strategy behind this move and other developments on the Hill today. Let's bring in our terrific trio, minus Michelle Austin, who's out of town. Lindsay Doyle of Summa Strategies is dressed up as the former liberal insider today, Halloween after all. Ernst Cliff Strategy Group's Robin Sears' costume is that of a former NDP insider. And Greg Weston, also of Ernst Cliff, has no tricks or treats for any party. It's the picture of neutral political operations. Thank you all for coming in. Yeah, that area. Okay, immigration. I'm wondering if this response signals that they're starting to pick up something out there. The Canadians have just about had enough about immigration. I know we're getting worldwide accolades for this. Robin, what's your sense on all this? Is this immigration fatigue?
Well, I do have to say it's certainly disappointing, if not cowardice. I mean, in 1913, we accepted 400,000 Canadians. When Pierre Trudeau became prime minister, we accepted twice as many immigrants per capita as this Trudeau government has announced it intends to do. When you have that history and you have some of the finest economic advisors in the world telling you, you really got to do something about this because several of the people on this panel are going to be dead within a very limited period of time, and we represent... We represent a very significant chunk of the existing population.
That's a problem.
Yeah. It's a disappointing decision. I don't understand it.
How do you respond to that?
I think immigration needs to be done responsibly. I think it's a broader conversation that needs to happen in conjunction with the provinces, in conjunction with municipalities. And the one thing we saw, I think, when there was the push to bring in 25,000 Syrian refugees before... when was it, February of this year, there was an immense amount of effort and coordination that took place between the three levels of government. There was likely some strain along the way because it was a huge challenge, a very rewarding one that I think will pay dividends to Canadian society. But I don't think that what, Mr. Barton and others, recommended 10 days ago or so is likely to be implemented but a week later. But I do notice that there is a trend moving towards that. Increasing economic immigrants in particular. But I think what the government's done is responsible. Let's not forget that the levels prior to the influx of Syrian refugees were 260,000. Yeah. So moving up to 300 is a step in the right direction. But a lot of those recommendations for increased immigration were up to 2030. So we still have some time to grow.
Good point. Greg?
Yeah, there's lots of time to catch up on this. The one thing the Liberals know is that they're, the citizens aren't going to be in the streets with torches saying, more immigration, please bring us more immigration.
Right.
It's just not one of those types of things. I think everybody understands that we need it and how critical it is to this country. It always has been. But I don't think it's the catastrophic outcome that Robin is talking about. They talked about increasing basically the level by 150,000 over 5 years. That's 30,000 a year. So if you delay it by a year, do the math. It's not insurmountable.
Yeah, but Greg, here's the problem. It's not catastrophic. It is disappointing because, unlike Chantel's comment that it's an aspirational thing to get to this number, we have a long waiting list of people who would be great to have in this country. They will make other decisions.
There's other places.
But you need to be able, I think what Canadians have always thought, all the polling I've ever seen on this subject is Canadians are all for immigration, but make sure that it's done well. Mm-hmm. And
which we've always done.
Exactly. And if suddenly bumping the numbers is going to overload the system, I think we saw that with the refugees. I'm not saying it was certainly a great program, but look, we're still trying to settle that the 25,000 refugee families that we brought in here. So I think that's what Canadians are, just say, do it, but do it well. And I think what you'll see over the next 5 years is next year it'll go up by 35 and then maybe 40 the year after that, and you'll still get to the same result.
It would probably depend on the economy. If the economy starts going down, people go, I don't think we should bring in immigration to take our jobs away from us. I think that, but we're feeling okay now. Or do you think
well, they're gonna... or bring in people who aren't going to have jobs. Right. I mean, it's not fair to them either.
But so. Economic migrants are not Syrian refugees, Greg. I mean, the challenge here is that we have one thing about which we are better than anybody else in the world. It's this. Successful
the
immigrant
economist right
immigration.
Now. On the stands right now. Okay.
Absolutely. We're still doing it, though, just as a reminder. Still happening.
It's aspirin,
not
right
stopped.
Conservative candidate Stephen Blaney.
Famous champion of immigration.
Well, no. But he did, in a related question, he was on Question Period yesterday talking to Evan Solomon. I'll play you a clip of what went down. It is kind of odd, and, well, you can make up your own mind. Here it is.
Why is it so urgent? Why would you say you'd use the notwithstanding clause, which would overturn what would be a Supreme Court decision, when other candidates, Deepak Oberoi, Michael Chong, have all said you're on the wrong track, Stephen Blaney?
To me, you know, Deepak Oberoi and Michael Chong are model of integration. And multiculturalism is about welcoming Canadians from all around the world, no matter what is their beliefs or their where they come from.
Okay, let me pull back. First of all, Michael Chong, of course, was born in Canada, so I don't know how he, I don't know if he integrated. He's a Canadian by birth.
Born in Windsor, Ontario, Michael Chong. All right, Michael Chong did respond today. This caused a bit of a Twitter furor. Here's what Michael Chong said. He said, I'm not an immigrant, but parents were. I'm proud of their story of integration. I think my friend Stephen Blaney was making that point. Class act by a classy rival candidate. Stephen Blaney did come out and also said today that, you know, I was talking about the family integration. So I guess, Lindsay, I'll go to you on this one. How big a blooper was that for Stephen Blaney?
Well, I think I'll give him the benefit of the doubt that that was what he initially meant to say or what he was referring to. But let's not confuse it with what is a truly dangerous line of narrative and just more thematics that are coming out of Stephen Blaney's campaign. And, you know, he starts it off by saying, let's go right back to the niqab debate and go from there. And so you have to kind of question the intentions of these types of comments and these types of initiatives from his campaign. And I don't think they're going to bode well for him, not just amongst conservatives. Obviously, there was a huge Twitter backlash against the comments that he made. So he's got to be pretty careful. If I were him, I would focus on something else. Integration, whether he's referring to, you know, his fellow conservatives or their parents or grandparents, it's just a really dangerous theme to be discussing.
All right, Greg. Shake it out.
Yeah. This is a pattern forming here. Stephen Blaney virtually unknown outside his home province, and probably a lot in his province, is going to the tried and true strategy of you can make a big splash and get lots of attention by saying really smart things or really not smart things. And at least he's being consistent.
Is this reflecting sort of a deeper narrative that's going on in this leadership thing? Or that?
Let me be a little bit harsher than Lindsay about this. Can one imagine the roles being reversed? Can you imagine Michael Chong making a comment like this about another Canadian who did not happen to be white? I don't think so. So I think it's a little hard to say that this was entirely accidental on Mr. Blaney's part. And I agree with Greg and Lindsay that, you know, we came through an election. We are watching the close of an election down south, where this kind of dog whistle politics stirs up the worst sentiments in a community. You can't play games with this stuff. It doesn't go back in the box very easily. I think Kelly Leach and Stephen Blaney should think about what it will mean for their party when they face the electorate not their own members, just as Donald Trump did not think of that with respect to what he's done to the Republican Party.
Yeah, and keep in mind, the Hill Times talked to Michael Coates, who's retiring as from Hill and Knowlton. He said, be careful, because you can go to the dark side if you go one step too far. And I don't know. I don't know if this is where we're headed or not. Any thoughts on that, either you two? No. Okay.
Well, yeah.
You're just tongue-tied still, aren't
you? It's a dark side.
I was thinking dark side. Oh, that's...
That's where you went, Weston, after you left journalism, okay?
Frank, I ran into Frank McKenna out in Calgary. He said I was the only person he'd known who I'd gone from the dark side to the darker side. The point of this is that we have a recording mechanism now called the internet when all of this stuff is going to stay live. And all that the Stephen Blaney is doing right now is he is producing wonderful clips for the Liberals and the New Democrats and anybody else to run during the next election campaign and thereon. And it will be damaging and it will stick. And for all of them, they really, Robin's right. They got to think about, are they going to kill their party where they're going?
On a far happier note, we'll quickly end our little chat with the CETA signing yesterday in Brussels by the Prime Minister. But today it was a very weird thing went down. Because Chrystia Freeland brought up and thanked the Harper government and went across the aisle and hugged Ed Fast from the Conservative side, to who was part doing some of the heavy lifting on this deal. Have you ever seen anything like that, Robin? I mean...
Yeah, I mean, we've had cross...
Well, only in a real crisis. I'm talking about a free trade deal.
Well, we've had cross-the-floor amity in the past. I think it shows class because, after all, they were last week attacking the Harperites for not finishing it and celebrating it, and I think maybe some of us on this panel might have been. So to say they did a good deal of the work that the Liberals got the credit for is kind of gracious.
It is gracious. Okay, you both nodded.
No, I agree.
I handed this gift to you, Lynn.
No, I thought it was an extremely classy move for certain. And this deal took 7 years to get done, and certainly, you know, it hasn't been easy in the past number of weeks. But I think for Ed Fast, yeah, he did a lot of heavy lifting. I'm so glad that it's done. I think everyone is glad that it's done. Mm. Now let's move forward with the provinces and territories and get to ratification. But very pleased to see what happened today.
Very smart piece of strategy because it moved the focus away from who did what to the deal. The deal's done and
became a Canadian trial.
Smart strategy. They probably consulted one of you three. All right. Thank you all. Have a happy Halloween. Coming up, we'll have the latest act in the three-ringed U.S. election circus, and we'll bring in a social media expert to dissect the power of Twitter in the campaign and who's the tweeting list of them all. Such a word. Please stay with us.
Why in the world the FBI would decide to jump into an election with no evidence of any wrongdoing with just days to go?
And I have to give the FBI credit. That was so bad what happened originally, and it took guts for Director Comey to make the move that he made in light of the kind of opposition he had, where they're trying to protect her from criminal prosecution.
Oh, my goodness. Well, it's over a week from tomorrow. The campaign will end. The U.S. gets a president-elect. But is 8 days enough for Donald Trump to stage a come-from-behind miracle and beat frontrunner Hillary Clinton? Well, our man on the election beat might not have that answer, but he has the lay of the land as it sits today. Richard Madden joins us from the CTV Washington Bureau. That was quite the October stink bomb that dropped there, Richard. How big a help for Trump and how big a hurt for Hillary Clinton?
Well, certainly given Trump some badly needed momentum, and you can see by just where he's going on the campaign trail is giving clues as to how much momentum Trump thinks he has. He said those comments today in Michigan, a Democratic-leaning state, that Trump obviously feels that he can pull from the Democrats and turn that red, and that would be that would help his path to 270, those key electoral college votes, on election night. He's obviously seizing upon this, and it's nothing but a headache for Hillary Clinton on two levels. Not only is it reviving that big FBI scandal the Clinton campaign hoped to put it behind him, behind her, but it also ties in some of these other Democrats the Clinton campaign wanted to distance themselves from. This whole investigation by the FBI is linked to Huma Abedin, who's Clinton's top aide. It's her estranged husband, the disgraced Congressman Anthony Weiner. So it's just a big headache for the Democrats, and it's nothing but a gift for the Republicans. Now, how this will play out is a little unclear. The so-called October surprises don't always have the impact that pollsters suggest they do. And I'm thinking back in 2000, remember this, Don, when just about a week before the election, it was revealed George W. Bush had a DUI. And a lot of people were suspecting this is going to sink his campaign. It didn't. Clinton says that a lot of voters have already made up their minds despite this whole email headache that it's been causing her. So it's one of those things. November 8th, we'll know for sure.
Well, she's fighting ghosts here, right, Richard? We don't know anything about these emails. And I'm wondering, is there any chance the FBI is going to be forced by public pressure or to release it? Because there's allegations that they're actually breaking the law by doing what they've done.
Well, exactly. The FBI's letter to Congress was really vague. They said they weren't sure what was in those emails. We don't know what's contained in those emails, but the optics are absolutely horrible for Clinton. And you can see, and what you heard today, she's trying to turn it on the FBI, questioning the timing, questioning their motivations. We've already heard some Democrats calling on the FBI director to resign. There was another senator from Tennessee today who echoed those sentiments, suggesting that there might be some political consequences behind it. But it doesn't matter. The focus now is on Clinton. It's negative, and it does nothing but help the Donald Trump campaign, as we said, with 8 days to go.
All right. So what's the sense in the next move? How long are the legs on this? Are we going to be talking about this tomorrow or Wednesday or Friday? How long do you think it's going to go?
Yeah, I think Trump's going to be hammering this one until Election Day. But it's not really the popular vote that, you know, both these candidates want to bring up, although it helps. The real story is where they're going. So as I said earlier, Trump is in Michigan today. If he flips that state blue, he's going to Colorado. If he flips that state red, that will help him get his path to 270. Right now, he needs Florida. Florida right now is showing that Trump is narrowing the gap. Some polls even suggest he's ahead. So if Trump picks up Ohio, he picks up Michigan, he picks up Florida, and he picks up Arizona and Colorado, that's not a bad path to the White House, but he has a very narrow window to do it, whereas Clinton really needs to maintain her advantage in some of these key swing states. But again, it looks like it just might be a photo finish if it turns voters off.
All right, I don't give this FBI director a long life in his current position if Clinton wins, but we'll see. All right, Richard, thank you.
You bet. All right, thanks, Donald.
All right, social media is playing a more active role than ever in this campaign, and Twitter's casting a long shadow over the race thanks to occasional rants from Republican candidate, the real Donald Trump. Let's tap into Twitter wars with Jennifer Hollett. She is with the social media force. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, it's great to be back.
In a very different capacity.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
Twitter by the tweets. Who's the biggest in the 140 characters technology?
It's Donald Trump. And this whole campaign has revolved around Donald Trump. A big part of the Twitter experience is, what is he going to say? How is he going to say it?
Yeah.
And then when you actually look at the share, so he has close to 13 million followers on Twitter. Clinton is behind at 10. That doesn't mean how people are going to vote. But even as we've followed the debates, it does revolve around what Donald Trump has said and then how we're all responding and trying to process it.
Well, he makes news, though.
He does.
He says, I'm unshackled now, he says on Twitter.
Yeah, and then those tweets end up on shows like yours, right? He's using tweets as a form of press releases and a call-in response as well. We've also never seen a presidential candidate actually do their own tweets, and sometimes at 3 a.m.
Yeah, I think that you might have had a couple of glasses of wine before you tweeted some of those.
He doesn't drink, actually. This is Donald Trump. Yeah.
Sleep deprivation then. And Clinton probably goes through a committee before every tweet goes out, right?
Right. And there's no question both campaigns have strong digital teams. And I think you're going to see the influence in upcoming Canadian races, whether it's, you know, federal, provincial, or municipal. But it's that authenticity or that average Joe appeal that Trump has that does translate really nicely to Twitter. And also, part of the Twitter experience is creating and making things in response. So we've seen hashtags and memes and GIFs and movements in response to the U.S. election. And I think that's part of the coping strategy, yeah, because yeah, we've never witnessed anything like this.
I don't know if Canada is rubbing off in this election. Are they monitoring Justin Trudeau's Twitter feed
very
closely?
Well, yes, we actually, we did check that. And right now, Hillary Clinton is not following Justin Trudeau.
What?
And neither is Donald Trump. But that is something we like taking a look at, is seeing the interaction between world leaders and soon-to-be world leaders. So, but I have to say, Justin recently surpassed the 2 million mark on Twitter, and then, of course, the upcoming one-year anniversary. But for Canada, that's like really high follower count.
Is that right? Okay,
yeah.
Well, tell us a bit about the history of what's going on Twitter, where these debates go down and stuff like that. Like, I mean, I haven't watched those debates, and I can't even keep track of Twitter. It looks like a giant blur
sure,
as the tweets go by. But, you know, how active is Twitter on debate night? And who's getting the most traction from these?
Yeah, so something new for us on the platform is we've actually broadcast the debates on Twitter. So
right,
you've been able to watch the three presidential debates and the VP debate, watch the video and see the conversation. The share for the most part has been on Trump's side, yet Hillary is gaining more and more momentum. And again, just because people are talking and tweeting about Donald Trump doesn't mean that they're going to be voting for Donald Trump. But it has been so shocking, the various things that he has said. And all these animated GIFs that also come out during the debates in terms of, like, what Hillary says or doesn't say in response. So in terms of, like, some of the, like, actual stats, I'll share some of the data. The most tweeted moment in the last debate was the fact that he refused to say what he would do if he didn't win, right? And in terms of would he accept the results. And that, I think, is a big part of this discussion on what might happen a week tomorrow. And in terms of top tweeted about topics, number one, foreign affairs. Number two, the economy. And number three, last time, it was reproductive rights, which was a big part of the debate.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, election night, that Twitter feed is going to go nuts. So it'll be interesting to watch.
Yeah, and actually, we're partnering with BuzzFeed. So back to, like, how people are, like, memeifying and having fun with this election. That's a big part of it.
We'll watch for that. Thanks, Jennifer.
Yeah, great to be here.
Okay. Coming up, Canada's prison watchdog is seeing too much pepper flying in the face of inmates without apparent cause. The correctional investigator is up next with his observations and recommendations from this year's annual report. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, the state of inmate treatment in Canada's prisons is a constant concern of Canada's correctional investigator. Howard Sapers filed his annual report today, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome, Mr. Sapers. On pepper spray, it sounds like they're spraying first and thinking of other methods later. What's going on?
Well, the use of pepper spray has tripled over the investigation period.
Over how long the period?
Yeah, since 2010.
Okay.
So it's tripled. This number of serious security incidents that you think might require that kind of intervention have been relatively stable.
Hmm.
So we're seeing a disconnect. And so we tried to figure out why. We don't have a really good answer as to why, but we know that the use of pepper spray is escalating. It's escalating well above any increase in the incarcerated population. It's escalating well above any increase in security incidents. And most troubling, it's escalating inside the regional psychiatric centers. So these are the hospitals, actually, that are operated by the Correctional Service of Canada. Very ill people.
Mentally
ill people. Four times out of 10, if they're involved in a security incident, including self-injury or a suicide attempt, the first response is pepper spray.
But I'll play devil's advocate here. What's the alternative? I mean, it could be dangerous to go and try and restrain them. You might want to, you know, just get them sort of disoriented and then move in.
Penitentiaries haven't become more dangerous. So prior to 2010,
right,
we were seeing all kinds of other techniques being used. Just talking to people, just changing the circumstances, trying to de-escalate things. In a hospital, in forensic hospitals, the same kinds of patients are housed. They're not pepper sprayed. On the street, we actually have seen a decrease in the use of inflammatory agents and pepper sprays in police-citizen interactions. So certainly the police are involved in lots of use of force incidents, but you don't see them always drawing for a weapon. So it's a weaponized response inside a correctional center, and we've seen actually a decrease in some of the accountability. So we're seeing more use of pepper spray, less accountability, very little monitoring.
Right, right. I talk to you about recommendations all the time. You did 27 on this particular report. Do you usually get a helpful ear from the government? Do they act on your recommendations?
Yeah, you know, actually, even over the last period, we've seen a pretty good response to the mm-hmm. recommendations. Last 5 years, it was a little more challenging to get traction on the recommendations. Mm-hmm. This year, the really good news is that there's 27 recommendations, 23 have been accepted in whole or in part.
Including the pepper spray
And so there's going to be a study of the use of pepper spray. They're going to look at the policy around accountability. I'll encourage them to go even further and to mm-hmm. perhaps do it a little faster. But it's a good start.
One area you've been very aggressive on over the years is the idea of solitary confinement. Yeah. And you say there's a problem there. So there's a case of a 23-year-old First Nation man, Adam Capé. He's been in isolation. He was in isolation for 52 months at Thunder Bay. And this is blowing up in the Ontario legislature because it's being described as torture, although Kathleen Wynne came out today and just called it extremely disturbing. When you read about that case, what was your reaction?
Well, first of all, let me say that's all I've done is read about it. It's provincial jurisdiction. I don't have any authority, and I also don't have any inside knowledge of it.
You've never been shy about sharing your opinions.
Don, it shocked me. It shocked me that we would have not just somebody in segregation for 4 years, but that we would have somebody awaiting trial in segregation for 4 years. Because this young man, as I understand it, has been charged with a serious offense, and he's awaiting trial. So you've got an access to justice issue, as well as the human rights issues around those conditions of confinement. Certainly, if this happened in a federal penitentiary, it's something that we would be investigating quite rigorously.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a sad state of affairs, because as you say, you're presumed innocent and just there for 52 months. And I think the reports are they kept a light on his cell the whole time.
Yeah, 24 hours a day in artificial light. And again, according to the reports, totally disoriented as to time and place, losing speech capacity, etc.
Wow. Sad state. Well, thank you, Howard Sabres. Appreciate you coming in.
Good to see you again.
All right. The Transportation Safety Board has a wish list of must-do improvements to air, rail, and water safety. Unfortunately, the government isn't acting on all those recommendations. The chair joins us after these messages. Please stay with us. Well, the new watch list out today looks the same as the old watch list as the Transportation Safety Board tries to nudge the government to increase the safety of those traveling by air, rail, and water. Kathy Fox is the chair of the board. She joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you
nice
for having me.
With us. So why are you having so much difficulty? I mean, these recommendations are not rocket science. They make sense.
Well, the watch list is really the 10 key safety issues that need to be addressed to improve the safety in Canada's transportation system. We were able to remove one item from our last watch list. We've removed railway crossing safety because a lot has been done to reduce the risk in that area. 8 of our issues have carried over from the previous watch list, and we've introduced 2 new ones. So these are the tough issues, but we feel we need to continue to push for change and highlight the risks that exist.
Okay, but I go back and say these watch lists are that put out for a reason. There are things you've identified in air, water, and rail that need to be acted on for the safety of the public. One would think a government would be anxious to do that because that's their responsibility.
Well, if we look at each one individually, we have seen action taken. For example, in marine safety, the government has introduced a number of regulations, but they don't go far enough yet to address some of the issues that we've pointed out. Things like stability assessments and user-friendly guidance for fishermen. Things like wearing personal flotation devices, having more regular safety drills, and so on. So it's not just up to Transport Canada to act, it's also up to other stakeholders, whether it be operators of airlines, railways, and fishing vessels, or whether it's the crew themselves.
Well, let me put you on the spot then. Give me 2 recommendations you think of this report are most urgent in terms of priorities.
Well, they're all a priority. I can't choose any one over the other. But certainly we believe that in air, for example, if Airport operators look at the risks off the end of their runways, that they can mitigate the situation where an aircraft overruns a runway, as happened last week in LaGuardia. That airport or that airlines can do more to reduce the number of unstable approaches that continue to a landing that can end up in an accident. Mm-hmm. And also that NAV Canada and other groups can do more to reduce the risk of a catastrophic runway incursion. The two new issues that we've put on the list, one is with respect to railway fatigue, particularly for crews of freight trains, and then the one you've just been talking about, which is that sometimes Transport Canada takes too long to address our recommendations. They advise us they're going to take action. They give us a timeline, which seems reasonable, but then year over year, those timelines slip. And that's why we put this on the watch list this year.
But truckers, for example, have to check in and they're monitored very closely how far they can run. Why shouldn't an engineer be catering to that same sort of situation? You don't want an engineer falling asleep when he's whipping along at, you know, 80 kilometers an hour down a rail where there's all kinds of problems ahead.
That's true. Each railway company is required to have a fatigue management plan. There are limitations, for example, minimum hours of rest that railway crews have to have, as well as maximum hours that they can work. The issue is really around the scheduling practices, particularly when you talk about freight trains. So the employees tend to operate in pools, and it's first in, first out. So they are not exactly sure when they're going to be called in to work. They have had their minimum rest, but they may think, oh, I'm going to work at midnight. They get called in at 6, so they don't have an opportunity for rest. Or they think they're going to be called later, or they think they're going to be called earlier, rather, and they end up being called later, and they're up for a long period of time. So we think the rules of fatigue science are well known, and they need to be applied to scheduling.
I don't know if this is going to make the watch list of the future, but there's a story out that Transportation Canada has exempted these small business planes from regular safety inspections, like the kind that killed Jim Prentice a couple weeks ago. Does that concern you?
Well, we've seen this bulletin that was issued by Transport Canada, and we don't normally comment on internal bulletins to their staff outside the context of an investigation. But following on the investigation we did into the orange helicopter, emergency helicopter that crashed in Ontario in 2013, we made 3 recommendations to Transport with respect to safety management, with respect to safety oversight, and we're going to look at that bulletin in the context of our assessment of the minister's response to those recommendations, and we'll be publishing that soon.
Okay, we'll look forward to that. Thank you, Kathy Fox. Appreciate you coming on.
Thank you very much.
All right, 6 Ontarians picked up their lifetime lottery win today as Prime Minister Trudeau elevated them into the Senate. Will it serve as independents, or will they? Our press gallery looks at the latest half dozen to see if they're hacks or not. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Time for our Monday duo of press gallery members to put their reality check on today's parliamentary spin. Laura Stone is a writer for the Globe and Mail. John Iveson is a columnist for the National Post. Welcome to you both. Nice to have you here. We've got 6 new senators for Ontario. We'll have rollies as we talk about them. John, are you dazzled, impressed by this election?
Well, let me say, before I launch into this, that I actually think the process is not a bad idea. The idea that you've got a independent senators, obviously the government, any government was limited in what it could do to reform the Senate. Harper tried, failed. So you're left with this. The idea of an independent, arm's-length body recommending worthy people to become senators, not a bad idea. And it happened in the House of Lords in Britain. You have crossbenchers. They act as a kind of jury. You've got the partisans on either side, and then, in theory, the crossbenchers go with whoever's got the best argument.
Okay.
The problem here, I think, is that while they may not all be big L liberals, card-carrying, donating liberals, although some of them are, of the 15, I think 2 are, but they're almost, to a man and woman, small L liberals. I mean, I think that the political or ethnic and gender diversity has been achieved. I don't think political diversity has been achieved, and I think you're going to end up with a very like-minded, homogenous group of people who still wield tremendous power, and it's going to be partisan politics by other means.
Huh, that's interesting, because there are like literally 2 more, 3 more Senate appointments, which will be probably coming this week.
Well, 6 more from
Quebec. I know, but they then can have the largest block if they vote as a block in the Senate.
I disagree. I think they're really impressive candidates.
I didn't say that. I don't think they have ability or integrity. I'm just commenting on the fact that
But they're not party hacks. They're not
I'm not suggesting that, but
if you're saying they're all part of one way of thinking, well, they're not coming from the Liberal Party or the Conservative Party.
If you look at the background of a lot of these people, they're academics. They're people who've worked in human rights activists, gender-based political activists. There is a very track record to a lot of these people.
Like the Scotiabank vice president.
Yeah,
the Scotiabank vice president, who is the only businessman on that list, has donated to the Liberal Party for 3 years out of the last five.
Are we getting a preview of your column for tomorrow?
Go to www.nationalpost.com and read all about it.
We need as many readers as we can get.
Just because they're progressive, I don't think that they're necessarily going to side with Justin Trudeau. And I think that that's what's interesting about
this.
In the assisted dying debate, we saw a lot of these independents really appear to be thinking for themselves, having thoughtful comments, sending this legislation back to the government. And the government didn't want to change it in the way that these independent senators wanted them to. Let me be clear.
I'm not suggesting they're going to be whipped by the Liberal Party. Even the independent, the Liberals in the Senate can't be whipped by the Liberal Party because they're not formally attached to the governing caucus. But I'm just saying, if you put a bunch of like-minded political people in a room and let them deal with an issue, any issue, whether it be free trade or whatever it is, you're going to end up with pretty much the same answer.
They all have different backgrounds, though. I don't see how they can all think the same.
That's my point, is that they don't have different backgrounds.
They all have social justice backgrounds.
So you want to see, like, a Preston Manning or something appointed.
I think that that it's very hard to what is political independence? Because no two people could agree on what it is. And I think that's a very hard place to get to. I think the problem in the first place was that there's an advisory board, a permanent federal advisory board, and then there are provincial nominees brought in. The board itself was homogenous and like-minded. Again, a lot of academics, lawyers, people from a very elite, similar background, and inevitably, the people who are nominated look like the people who nominated them.
Yeah, it's sort of like the Order of Canada.
They were all Order of Canada people as well. I think just about everybody who's on the advisory board is an Order of Canada recipient.
It's an interesting argument, because actually Philip Lagasse was posting a thing today, and he basically said that what they're going to use the Senate for is as a liberal progressive enhancer. So legislation would go to the Senate, and it would be made even more progressive than it was, and the Liberals would be pretty happy to say, oh, it's the Senate that's doing this.
Well, The Liberals will no doubt point out and say this advisory board is arm's length. They made the recommendations. Now, what we don't know, though, is that there were 2,700 applicants. Who got rejected? We don't know.
Oh. Wow. Okay. Yeah. All right. Question period was live to the sounds of Bill Morneau's little fundraising tactics being inappropriate. He didn't break any laws, but he doesn't quite look like he meets Prime Minister Trudeau's litmus tests, where you don't even have to be, can't even be perceived to be taking, access for money. Laura, where's this going? This is the Globe and Mail has been leading the charge on this. I guess you're off
my wonderful
finance
boss.
Minister's Christmas card list. But I mean, where's this going to go? Are the Liberals going to have to make a change? Or are they just, because they're going ahead and having all these fundraisers, it doesn't look like it's going to end anytime soon.
Right. Well, I guess we'll have to see. There's one next week, so we'll see if Bill Morneau, finance minister, goes ahead with that. But I think where the story has legs is, as you say, Don, this goes against the spirit of the government's own rules. So until there's this perceived hypocrisy, I think we're going to continue to go after them, because it's going against the spirit of the open and accountable government principles that Trudeau said that they were going to uphold.
Yeah.
So I see it going on for a while until something has changed.
Hmm. John?
Well, I think the political parties need money. This is a proven way for them to raise money. We saw earlier in the year with Jody Wilson-Raybould going to the fundraiser on Bay Street to people who were clearly, it was a clear conflict of interest what she was doing. I mean, this is a continuation of it. They've obviously said to themselves, we're raising tons of money here. Is it worth taking the political hit? And they've obviously said yes.
See, I don't remember the Conservatives doing this, did they?
I don't think they did it like this. No, they might have. I mean, they obviously raised tons of money from smaller donors, and it didn't seem to be quite as elitist, for want of a better word.
I think that's where what the Liberals should do. They should host larger events with smaller donations, because it's more, accessible for everyone. Who has $1,500 to pay? That's someone's mortgage to go to one of these events at someone's private home.
I mean, I think the Conservatives, they would do fundraisers, but they would be in a town hall somewhere, not in a hotel room or somebody's private home.
That's the problem, isn't it? The optics are there. Okay, quick word, last word from you on this one, John. Fiscal update tomorrow. Are we going to see any surprises? Is this a mini budget by another name?
I think there's going to be a lot of surprises. I think they'll announce that the deficit's going to come in under 30 billion, which is a kind of psychological barrier. We'll get a little bit of detail on the infrastructure bank. But I don't suspect big shocks. Their big problem, though, is that, as Pierre Poilievre pointed out in question period today, 1 year in, they haven't created one net new full-time job.
Ouch.
And they're now saying, well, trust us, it's coming. Well,
but is the deficit figure going for a big boost?
Well, I think we'll see, I guess. Some of the banks are suggesting it will do.
Okay. Probably the more interesting development tomorrow. The Power and Muncie budget officer is announcing how much revenue the government's going to get from legalized pot.
That's why we won't be going through $30 billion, because we'll be making
so much money going up in smoke. All right. Thank you both. Appreciate you coming in. And that's it for today's Political Power Plays. Scott Laurie, standing by with the latest news headlines. Thanks for watching the broadcast or listening to the podcast. Here's how you can reach us with show reactions and ideas. We're back tomorrow with the government's fiscal update. Tune in and find out the state of the economy and the tricks or treats from the finance minister. Have a safe and happy Halloween night.